Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Central Library, and thank you all for joining for tonight's program. My name is Daniel Nguyen, and I'm one of the librarians that works upstairs on the business department, upstairs on level 7. We want to thank you to the LA Bay Book Company for inviting us to host this event tonight. And a special thank you to the Seattle Public Library Foundation, whose support makes possible so many of our free library programs. Tonight's author is the senior economics contributor at Marketplace, American Public Media's nationally syndicated public radio business and personal finance program. He's also the economics commentator for the Minnesota Public Radio. He writes regular columns on economics and public policy for Bloomberg Businessweek and on personal finance for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Please join me in welcoming Chris Farrell to the Central Library for a conversation about his new book, On Retirement, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Think About Work, Community, and the Good Life.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, I'm honored to be here, and thank you for being here. And what I'd like to do is make some remarks about my book, On Retirement, and then open it up for your questions. So just to start off, you know, when I was growing up, there were three remarkable women who were in the background of our family, Aunt Ella, Aunt Julia, Aunt Agnes. And they were nuns with the Sister of Charity of New York. And it's an order of nuns that focuses on children in poverty. And I just loved them. And, you know, when you're 6 years old, they really cared about what you thought. Plus, they were nuns. You know, they wore the black habits and they had the black caps and Irish-tinged New York accents. And one of them really stood out, Aunt Ella, Sister Lucille Marie Farrell. And what I learned later on is what a remarkable career she had had. So she graduated from college. She got her master's and her PhD from Fordham University during World War II. She ran an orphanage in New York State. She worked at New York Foundling. She taught mathematics at Mount St. Vincent. She built parochial schools in Long Island. And in the early 1970s, she testified before Congress in the successful effort to bring nuns into the Social Security system. So the last time I saw Aunt Ella was at the Common and Mary the Queen in Yonkers, which is a home for aged nuns in Yonkers. And as always, when you're talking with Aunt Ella, you talk about children and poverty and education and family. She always had a lot of questions. But what always stuck with me is when she signaled it was time for me to go. She said, "Chris, I have to go take care of the aged. There's work to be done." Aunt Ella was 96 years old. And part of my thesis is that Aunt Ella in any era is a remarkable person, but her attitude, her mindset is going to become over the next 10, 20, 30 years, become increasingly common as we age as a population, which is why we're having this conversation these days. You know, America is getting older, and you have the leading edge of the baby boom generation is filing for Social Security and Medicare, and the baby boomers is 76 million born between 1946 and 1964. But it's not just that the boomers are getting older, it's that we're living longer. So when Franklin Roosevelt signed Social Security in 1935, you know, rounding out the numbers, average life expectancy was 62 years. It's now about 79 years. And I just wonder, you know, living longer is good news. But in much of the discussion about an aging population, it's treated as dire news. And, you know, it's almost like we're, you know, have that sense of, you know, paraphrasing Hunter S. Thompson, fear and loathing about aging in America. And there's a couple of reasons why people are really concerned about the aging population. I mean, part of it is, and we all know this, is that the boomers are not saved enough for their retirement for a variety of reasons. But then it quickly gets even darker because You know, the sense is that these swelling ranks of the aging boomers, you know, they're going to drag down the economy. They're going to drag down economic growth. That, you know, the older workers aren't exactly considered risk takers and energetic. And at the same time, we'll have too few young people supporting far too many older people. And then the forecast really gets bleak, because then if we don't have a very strong economy and you got a lot of older people, then, you know, the cost of Social Security and Medicare is going to weigh down on the economy. And the thesis of my book is to hold on, that this gloom about an aging America belongs to a different economy, a different society. It's kind of like, you know, your grandfather's Oldsmobile, in that boomers, aging boomers, offer the opportunity to strengthen the economy, to rejuvenate the economy in our communities. Because many boomers are going to have the desire and the ability to work longer. And there was a survey came out recently. It was a Merrill Lynch Age Wave. Age Wave is a well-known demographic consulting firm. And, you know, but they came out with, so they surveyed people 50 and over still working. What did they want to do during their retirement years? 72% said they want to continue working. AARP does similar surveys. Their numbers are usually around 80%, depending on the year that they're doing it. And, by the way, it's not just people saying that they want to be doing it, but actually that the age of retirement is going up. And there are different factors at work, but for men, it's basically that a trend toward retiring earlier and earlier and earlier bottomed out in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and despite whatever happens to the business cycle, people are retiring slightly later. For women, it's more coming into the paid labor force, but again, it's still going to the same place. People are retiring later. And, of course, we have a lot further to go, as you can see, in terms of that. Nevertheless, there is this growing sense, this growing conversation about working during the last third of life. It might be contract work, it might be temp work, it might be bridge jobs, part-time work, starting your own business. But this is part of the conversation, the grassroots conversation that we're having these days. And there's a series of mutually reinforcing aspects of our economy that makes it much more practical for an older generation to continue to work. So part of it is that boomers are well-educated. And that's probably one of the most important aspects of this working longer. And they're healthier than previous generations. There have also been changes in our economy that just make it a lot more practical for people who were working longer. I mean, if we were having this conversation in the 1950s, 1960s, I mean, that's when smokestack America was the commanding heights of the economy, and mining and farming and fishing. Today, it's social services and information technologies. And it's just simply a lot easier to work in a cubicle or, you know, at a medical diagnostics clinic than it is to be mining for coal. I mean, that's just a much harder job. So this change in the economy is reinforcing or making it less easier for people to think about working longer. The other thing is there's growing appreciation that the workplace is a social institution. It's not just an income. It's actually a place where people care whether you show up. And people celebrate when someone has a baby, and they help people get through a divorce. And when they do the surveys of people who have retired, what do you most miss about your pre-retirement life? I always assumed that it would be income was number one. It's not. Income's on the list. It's actually fairly far down. The number one is colleagues, friends, people in the workplace, the connections from the workplace. And the other thing, you know, that I think more and more people have come to realize is that you spent a lifetime building up skill, building up knowledge, building up experience. And more people don't want to completely walk away from that. They want to continue to tap into their knowledge, tap into their experience, tap into what they know. Now, they don't necessarily want to be working a whole lot of hours, but they also don't want to walk away from what they've learned over a lifetime. They want to continue to contribute in the workplace in some form of an organization, or again, by starting their own business. And it's important to realize and to emphasize that not everybody can work longer. There are many low-income people who have worked at jobs, never had an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan, never had an employer-sponsored healthcare plan, They may be just burned out. There are other people, as we all know, health just cuts across all kinds of barriers. You may not be able to work longer. But if those who can work longer continue to work longer, or encouraged to work longer, and we make it easier for them to work longer, the wealth that is created and the taxes that are paid can support and improve the support for those who are not able to work as well. And one of the things is, how is this going to play out? And I don't know if you remember that Buffalo Springfield song, For What It's Worth. And I won't sing it for you, but boy, you really wouldn't want me to sing it for you. But it's, you know, something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. And there's a lot of experimentation going on. Joseph Coughlin, he's the head of the MIT Age Lab. He calls it the Baby Boomer Retirement Improv Act. And I think that's a really good way. It is an improv act. And any of you who have done improv, you know there's the real risk that you're going to fall flat on your face. So there's a lot of experimentation. And when you think about economics and personal finance and social changes, you know, there's a tendency to go toward the numbers, toward the mathematics, what might be equilibrium. But a lot of what economics is storytelling. It's a narrative. And when it comes to this rethinking of what is going on in this last third of life, we don't have a common narrative that we can share. So think about the narrative that we have about working longer. And, you know, this comes in the 19th century and up and through, actually for most of history, which is working longer is pretty accurate. You pretty came close to working until you died. And that's one image that a lot of people have about working longer. And then we had 1935 Social Security Act, you had Medicare, you had defined benefit pension plans were more common in the post-World War II era, and most importantly, you just had an incredible era of economic growth, and retirement became associated with leisure. And even people who would, like my parents, never moved to Florida, never moved to Arizona, wouldn't have thought of moving to Florida, Arizona. But you can watch an episode of Seinfeld, and we would be laughing, you know, when Seinfeld goes down and he visits his parents and his uncles and everyone in their retirement community down in Florida, because this is such a powerful image about what retirement is. But it's also a very, very short period of history. And I was recently out in Vareto, which is it's a new development that's being built on the outskirts of Phoenix. And this guy was talking to him, and he said something that really has struck with me. And he said, you know, here's the thing we've learned, Chris. You know, you retire. You stop working. And you have a drink at 4:30 in the afternoon, and it's a great drink, and it's a wonderful moment, because you're not worried about, you know, what's going to happen, what meeting you're going to tomorrow, or whether you have to fire someone, or you're going to get fired, or whether you're meeting your projections. It's really relaxing, and no one cares. But then the thing is, you have a drink at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you realize no one cares. And when you have one at 1, you realize it's time to go back to work in some form or fashion. And so I think the new narrative will require something of a new song. And this is from Sir Paul McCartney, which he wrote when he was 16 years old, when I'm 64. And we'll put a new lyric in there, which is, if I'm at work till 9:45, would you lock the door? And I went to a concert recently that he gave. He's well into his 70s, and he's still extremely active. So part of this is, the personal finances of working longer are really compelling. I mean, they're really strong. So if you think about most people in their savings, don't have much savings. So even earning a slim part-time income will dwarf whatever they make off of their investments. But more importantly, continuing to work means that you may be able to add to your savings. You may be able to actually start saving for your retirement, because the kids are gone now and they're creating their own lives. Or at least you're not tapping into savings if you have some savings. And then a big part of that is, if you continue to work, you know, you have to support yourself off your savings for a shorter period of time. And then the most important thing is that by continuing to work, it allows the delay for filing for Social Security. So the difference between filing for Social Security at age 70 versus age 62 is the benefits more than 75% larger. So for the typical worker, the most important decision they make when it comes to retirement is, when do you file for Social Security? And so Robert Shackelford, he's an economist at the Congressional Budget Office, and he ran some numbers, and, you know, it's a simulation. And so it's a two-income couple, and they make $100,000 a year as household income. And if there's a standard that we all use, which is you need 80% of your pre-retirement income to maintain your standard of living during your retirement years. And then he just assumed average life expectancy. If you live to age 62, what's your average life expectancy? So he just ran off those numbers. So this two-income couple, if they file for Social Security at age 62, they need a portfolio to maintain their standard of living during retirement of $890,000. So this is where you see those numbers where people say, you know, you need at least $1 million to retire. If they wait till their full retirement age, which is age 66, they need a portfolio of $550,000 to maintain their standard of living. And if they wait till age 70 to file for Social Security, they need a portfolio of $260,000. So you can play with the numbers, you can play with the assumptions, but the personal financial impact of working longer is it's really considerable. Now, this is from the Stanford Center of Longevity, and it's their conservative projection about the 65-plus population in terms of the change in the embrace of work. And I think it's a pretty conservative number, but it gives kind of a sense of the flow that we're going to. And so one of the questions is, you know, what kind of jobs are people going to be doing? And, you know, a lot of it is going to be in the social service sector. A lot of it is going to involve or services, health, education being big sectors. And in many cases, what people are doing is they're going to take their existing skills and they're going to move to a different sector of the economy. So this is not a story about people who have been working at one place and then they're going to keep working at that place longer. In many cases, people are going to shift and they're going to leave one place, go to somewhere else, and take their skills. And there's a strand of commentary in this whole area that we're all kind of trying to figure out about, you know, you reinvent yourself and the reinvention mantra. So you've worked in a cubicle all your life, or you've been a corporate road warrior, and you go out to Napa Valley and you're having some wine and you think of a new way to have an organic, sustainable, organic wine, and some investors overhear your conversation and they lend you some money and you invest and you create this incredible wine, and Richard Branson will only serve your wine on his airlines, and Bill Clinton invites you to give a talk about how you go from the cubicle to the vineyard at the Global Initiative, and that may happen, but it's pretty rare, right? What most people are doing is they're taking their existing skills, and there's a reassurance that comes from tapping into what you know, but a lot of times going into a different sector of the economy, because that kind of gives you a creative push. It's you're surrounded by new people, you have some new challenges, and this is part of a big movement that you're seeing, is that people are also very interested in going from, say, the for-profit sector into the not-for-profit sector, which is a big part of this whole unretirement movement. Now, the other thing is, people starting their own companies. And now, when we think about entrepreneurship, it's usually, you know, a young person, right? It's Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, or Jack Dorsey of Twitter, or for an earlier era here, since we're in Seattle, you know, Bill Gates with Microsoft and the late Steve Jobs. But 23% of new business formation in 2013 was the 55 to 64 year old age group, and that's up from 14% in 1996. And when you look at other data sets, the trend is pretty much the same. Older people are starting businesses at an accelerating rate. And, there's a couple reasons for this. I mean, part of it is, you know, age discrimination is real. Age discrimination is a real barrier to getting a job. So you lose your job at 55, you lose your job at 60, and you're hitting a wall, you start your own business. And so part of it is that's what's going on. The other part that's going on is a lot of people sort of think about a business. They want to be their own boss. They've had some sort of an idea, and you're getting older, and you realize, hey, if I'm going to do it, I better do it now. And it's become a lot cheaper to start your own businesses in many respects. I mean, the kind of businesses that are being started a lot of times are more Schedule C businesses. You work out of your home. Because of technology, it's a lot cheaper. You can do your accounting. You can do a lot of things cheaper. It would have cost you a lot more money even 20 years ago. So this is part of what is going on, entrepreneurship. And it's also sort of one of the big things about this that I find very exciting is that it's a movement. And it's a movement that is facing a lot of barriers. And one of the biggest barriers is the stereotypes, that older people can't be creative, that older people are not innovative. And it's simply a stereotype. And if you get on an airplane and you go to New York City, there's an incredible exhibit at MoMA, Museum of Modern Art, on Matisse. And, you know, people generally agree that Matisse did his most creative work in the last decade of his life, which is the cutouts. And he did them from a wheelchair or from his bed. And there's just, I'm going there on Saturday to go see the exhibit. And the thing about Matisse, then you start realizing, well, that's Matisse, right? Okay, but then you start looking at more and more artists. And there's an economist at University of Chicago, David Gallinson, who's gone through all these artists, and there's just an incredible number of artists who actually, decade after decade, and they're doing their best work in their 60s, their 70s, and even their 80s. And then he's looked at other professions, and you find the same thing in many professions. And what he said is that when we see a young person do something extraordinary, we say, that's genius. When we see an older person do something extraordinary, we say, isn't that remarkable? But the thing is, we never added up how many remarkables there are. And so part of this is breaking down the stereotypes. And so two of my favorite examples of breaking down the stereotypes, one, we'll go way, we're going way away from the artistic market, and to BMW. Now, Germany has an older population than the U.S. and an older workforce than the U.S. And BMW got concerned about what this might mean for future productivity for their assembly lines in Germany. So they created what's called the pensioners line. And it reflected the older workforce that they expected to have in the future. And the pensioners line, the productivity, initial productivity, was lower than the productivity of its other assembly lines. And then they made 70 tweaks for a total cost of $50,000. So more comfortable shoes, different flooring, bigger computer screens, different chairs, I believe yoga, meditation. And the productivity of its pensioners line now matches the productivity of its other assembly lines. And the thing is, the lessons that it took from that experience, it has now moved to its other assembly lines, because why do you want your younger workers to hurt their back? Why do you want your younger workers to squint? They might be willing to do so, but why would you want them to do so? And the other example is, this is a couple years ago, P&G and Eli Lilly went to a consultant and said, will you create a company? And because we'd like to be able to tap into our retirees for special projects. And then Boeing joined them fairly early on, fairly quickly. And now there's a number of other companies that are involved. And what is the dynamic is that what big companies are trying to do is keep a fairly stable workforce. And that's one reason why they're not hiring the way that they would have in the past, because what they're trying to do is avoid laying off as many people in the future. Well, what that means is that's fine. Everyone's working flat out. But let's say you have an opportunity that comes up, or you have a special project that comes up. You don't have the bodies. You don't have the people to throw into it. So what you do is you tap into your encore, and these retirees come in, and they do a project on contract. Typically, it can be anywhere from a day to a couple of weeks to typically it's like 3 months. And then they go, and they go back to the golf course or wherever it is that they go. And what is striking about the conversations is everyone says how creative these retirees are. They're incredibly creative. And when you talk to retirees, say, well, why are you creative? I said, look, here's the deal. We're not worried about anything that has to do with corporate politics and the company, budgets, worried about someone taking my job. Says, none of that. All we're doing is solving a problem. And so I think that this is one of the, in a sense, their imaginations are unleashed. And this is not something that's going to happen tomorrow. It's not going to happen the next day. This is going to unfold over a period of time. And I think the analogy that I would draw is to the women's movement in the post-World War II era, the most powerful social movement that we've had. And, you know, it was back in 1979. It's not that long ago that women at Newsweek magazine could only be researchers or secretaries. They could not write stories. They could not be editors. There's a famous lawsuit. Well, the journalism profession has really changed. And I think that, as the women's movement has broken down barriers, and there's still more that needs to be broken down, there needs to be more changes. Similarly, we're going to see when we're dealing with age discrimination and a lot of these stereotypes that these barriers are going to come down for both men and women when it comes to aging. Now, this sort of approach to sort of thinking about this contract job, flex job, what am I going to be doing? It sort of has real implications for how we think about retirement planning. So, you know, we've had this conversation for the past 3 decades, right, about, asset allocation and stocks and bonds and saving for your retirement. And, you know, don't get me wrong, saving for retirement is important. Although I would argue just saving is important, whether you're saving for retirement or just whatever you're saving for, saving is important. But this working longer has some real implications for how you plan for the last third of life. Because the real question becomes, the question of the 90s and the early 2000s was, what is my number? Do I have enough to retire? But that question always assumed that you stopped working completely, that you walked away from the workplace and never earned a paycheck again. Now I think the question is, what do I want to do next? And one of the things that I've realized that in doing these interviews that I find very exciting is not just what I want to do next to earn a paycheck, but it's what I want to do next that I feel good about. And there's a real parallel between like young college graduates and people in their 60s or their 70s. And so when you think about, I imagine most of you, young people have come to you when they graduated from college and, what should I be doing? What would you recommend? Or do you have some advice for me? And, young college graduates really don't want to be living in their parents' basement, and they really do want to be earning an income, but they also want to be doing something that they feel good about, that they feel proud about, and we support them. And when you look at people in their 60s on these conversations, yes, I want to earn a paycheck, but I want to earn something that makes a difference. That's something that leaves a legacy, something that I feel good about. And this is part of the search. So part of it has implications for how you think about planning for retirement, which is really a key question, is what do you want to do next? Because what the data shows is that most people today, despite our images about people, going to Sun City or retirement is not working, that a majority of people today who retire do some kind of work. And what the data shows is that most people who retire go back to work within the first year or two. And and this comes from a study from this economist at the Rand Corporation, her conclusion is what people really want is a long vacation. And I also think that they need to figure out what it is that I want to do. You want to get away from, if you think about the organizations that you've worked in, there's a reward system, there's a penalty system, and people say, well, that's a smart thing to do, that's a dumb thing to do, why would you do that? I was talking to a woman last night who'd been in the high-tech industry, and 60 years old, and she wants to do something different, and all her friends are saying, "What? Get a job, come on, you know how to do high-tech," and she wants to do something different, and so she needs to remove herself from that group of friends who she really likes, but she wants to be around other people who are searching for something else to do. And so I think this retirement planning, this big question, what is it you want to do next? And one way of thinking about it is Jake Warner, he's the founder of Nolo.com, which is it's a self-help legal organization down in the Bay Area. And he told me this story, which has always stuck with me. He's very involved in the environmental movement. And you know, there's some very powerful environmental organizations in the Bay Area. And he says, someone who said, you know, they've had a good career, and they're 65 years old, and they'll show up their door, and they say, I'm retired, I really care about the environment, I want to do something. And he says, of course you'll welcome them, and you want to do something, but he says, then contrast that to somebody who about 5 years or 10 years before they retire, they start showing up, they start volunteering, we get to know them, they get to know us. And by the time they're 65 years old and they show up at our doorstep, we are begging them to retire because we know exactly, we have a position, we have a job, we know their skills, we know what we want them to be able to do. So I think this has, you know, so a lot of now retirement planning is thinking about your education, about your skills, about what it is you want to do. Do you have to pick up some additional education? And it also, you know, as part of this, so, and I also think as part of this is going to affect the way we think about our where we live. You know, the post-World War II era, the post-World War II move, particularly like I'm from Minnesota, right? You move to Arizona, or you move to California, or you move to Texas, Florida. And the thing is, the research is really compelling that more than 50% of all jobs come through a network. And some sort of somebody who knows somebody. It's usually like third degrees of separation. But more than half of all jobs come from a network. So if you're going to end up in a different part of the country, your network is left behind. And so as people work longer, I think this is actually really good for a lot of our communities, that people are going to stay longer in their communities, and they're going to stay because that's how they can get the kind of jobs that they can give back and to provide some meaning. Now, having said all this, this transition is not going to be easy. I think that right now, this whole conversation about unretirement or encore careers, third age, third stage, next chapter, there's a genuine grassroots movement going on. There are organizations that are being created around the country, like Women in Transition Network for a professional woman 50 and over. Encore.org has a wonderful network that it really helps people create nonprofits. AARP has started a new joint venture called Life Reimagined. There's just a lot of activity going on, but it's still a lot of it is a DIY movement. And I think that this is going to be the next wave of corporate benefits. And you're starting to see it with some companies. So Intel, for example, has, you're nearing retirement, you can apply for an Encore Fellowship. And what that does is it matches a near retiree with a nonprofit organization that needs its skills. And then you agree to work for a year, part-time, 6 months during the course of the year. And then Intel, I believe, provides a stipend of $25,000 plus healthcare benefits during that period of time. And that's to aid in the transition. IBM has a program similarly where if you want to make the transition into becoming a teacher, Hewlett-Packard does, Cisco. And then I went up to Herman Miller, which is up in Zeeland, Michigan, and Herman Miller, the office furniture maker. And what it has for its employees, it's open to everybody, but no one really takes advantage of it unless they're at least 55, is you can take up to 12 weeks off a year consecutive, and they have to be consecutive, and you don't lose any of your benefits or terms of service. You don't get paid during that period of time. And what they have found is that they get to keep workers longer this way because someone just wanted to take a vacation, they wanted to go to Florida, their parents are ill, they want to take care of them, they might want to get some education, they want to give a little try at starting their own business. So you do have some benefits out there. And one of the important experiments starting really this year and next year, mostly next year. So the federal government has come up with its rules for phased retirement. And so its phased retirement program is going to be, and the federal government is one of the older workforces in the country, which is why they've created this program. And the reason why it's launching 2015, 2016 is the government's come up with its basic rules, and now each agency can tweak it the way that it wants to, depending on its workforce and its needs. But the basic idea is that you'll work 20 hours a week and withdraw a partial on your pension. And in the 20 hours a week that you're working, you agree to mentor younger employees 20% of your time. And so as this phased retirement program rolls out, I think a lot of companies are very interested in it, and they're watching it very closely. And because actually a lot of benefit innovations have come from the federal government. And so if this succeeds, more than likely a lot of companies are going to adopt it, and it'll become a much more standard part of benefits. So then, you know, the last thing that I just want to end in my remarks and then open it up for questions is, you know, this is an improv act. This is an experimentation. We don't have a narrative. We don't exactly know how this is going to play out. But the real beneficiary of this period of time is not the boomers. The real beneficiary is the younger generation, is my 22-year-old. Because by the time my 22-year-old is in his 50s and 60s, there is going to be a common narrative. There is going to be a rethinking of what this last third of life is. And the really exciting aspect of that is how that feeds back and how does a younger generation think about its career over a lifetime. Because whether we live that life or not live that life, many boomers grew up with a very simple story. And actually, not that many lived it. But simple story was you went to school, you worked really hard, and then you stopped working. And what is happening if you're going to be working longer is it opens up greater possibilities, greater prospects for more experimentation throughout your work life, for multiple careers, for taking bigger risks, and sometimes working really hard, sometimes working a lot less hard. So I think that the really exciting aspect of this is how it's going to affect a younger generation and how they approach their jobs and their careers. And again, that younger generation, by the time they're in their 50s or 60s, is going to have a very different narrative, a very different story than working longer means working until you die, or at age 60, you simply stop working and never work again. So now you don't have to buy the book. That's what it's about. But I would love it if you would buy the book. I'm sure you would like it if they would buy the book. But that's sort of hopefully that sparks some questions or some challenges or brickbats. Please feel free. So the question is, and I'm just going to repeat it for the benefit of the taping, just so you know, I actually can hear you. is there generational tension that as boomers work longer, that's going to essentially clog up the pipeline for a younger generation that wants to be getting their job and advancing their careers? And I think it's a really good question. And I don't think so. And there's a couple of reasons why I don't think so. Part of it is economists call this the lump of labor theory. And they put a lot of effort into it. And when you look at the overall economy over the course of a business cycle, what it turns out is that when older workers are getting jobs, younger workers are getting jobs. And when older workers are not getting jobs, younger workers aren't getting jobs. And so it's kind of like we're more in this, all in this economy together. And so it's not so much of a zero-sum game as an expanding pie. So the analogy that I would draw is actually the women's movement. Because if you go back and recall back to the early 1980s, and I'm sure you read op-eds, that as these professional women come in, they're taking jobs away from men, there aren't going to be jobs for men. Well, what happened is the pie got bigger. It just did. There was a lot more job creation overall. And so I think that's more the story. But, you know, there's always that wariness, because if you look at a company, let's say a company is not growing. Now, what happens in that company? The older workers hold on to their jobs, and the younger people who can get out, and the ones who can't kind of see the pipeline blocked for them. So on the level of a firm, on the level of a company, it absolutely can happen. But I think overall for an economy throughout the business cycle, it's more about a growing pie than that people are at each other's throats, you know, scraping by for the scarce hotel rooms. The other thing is, and I can't prove this. Okay, this is a suspicion of mine. My suspicion is, as the unemployment rate comes down, that you have an older workforce that is so tired of being told to do more with less. And were unwilling to leave their job in 2010. Kind of nervous about leaving it in 2011. But what happens in 2015, 2016 if the economy continues to improve and the unemployment rate continues to come down? My suspicion is you're going to have a mass exodus out of a lot of companies. What I don't think is this mass exodus is then people are just going to stop working. But I think there's going to be a mass exodus to try something else. Or there'll be a mass exodus, I'm retiring. You know, that's what you'll tell people, but within a year or two going back to work. So that will also open up for a lot of younger people. It'll open up that pipeline for them. Because one of the things that, you know, part of it is, what is our language that we use? So there was a Mennonite minister that I interviewed, and he was 60, I think he was 65. And so he lasted in his career as about 10 years. So he'd been a welder, he'd been a truck driver. He'd actually been a Mennonite minister, I think, for about 20 years. And he felt it was time for him to move on. And so what he was trying to do was construct a week. So to construct a week, he worked 3 days a week. Then 2 days a week, he would do projects on the house. And they had a little cabin out in Kansas City. They had a little cabin out by a lake. And then the rest of the time was service. But he hadn't really figured it out. So he was driving one of those mobile transit trucks 3 days a week, moving people around, but he hadn't quite figured it out. But he would be in a gathering, and people say, "What are you doing?" And he tried to explain to them, and they kind of would look at him like, "What?" So then he would just say, "Well, I retired." They go, "Oh, great, yes," and everyone knew exactly what he had done. So I think a lot of us also a lot of times use that word retirement, even though we're not retired in the traditional sense. So I think as these boomers do their exodus, many of them are going to say, "I'm retiring." But my suspicion is, especially considering longevity, my suspicion is within 2 years, most of them will have gone back to work, but not in the same place. Yeah. So what happens to the nonprofits that are dependent on a pool of volunteers as more people work? I think that for the nonprofits, I think nonprofits are going to have to pay more. I mean, I think that's one of the implications of this. There's still a lot of volunteerism going on, and people will continue to volunteer. Because a lot of this working longer is part-time work. And so you're doing a part-time job where you're getting an income and then you're still volunteering and then you're with the grandkids or you're doing other things that you want to be doing. So I don't think it's, you know, I'm only going to do work for a paycheck. I'm not going to do volunteer. It's a combination of both, but time is also limited. So if you're doing some work for pay, you're not doing as much volunteer work as before. So I think you're right, and I think what the nonprofits are going to end up facing is coming up with ways to, and a lot of them are actually coming up with ways to pay people. It's not necessarily going to be much money, but to actually pay people. And I was talking to one group, it's a very interesting model they have, which is for professionals who are retired, and they get a stipend. So it's $15. And $5 goes to the nonprofit that arranges the work. And so you go work for a government agency or a nonprofit organization or somebody that needs your skills. So you're making 15, you know, 10 bucks an hour is your take-home pay. So this is absolutely nothing, right? But what they have found is because they're being paid, and it is costing the agency or the organization that they're working at some money, that everybody takes it much more seriously. That the person who's doing the what might have been volunteer work before, they really do show up. And the agency that's paying the money, they really make sure they take advantage of that person's skills. So, and again, that may be too little money for most people, and it might need to be increased. But I have a feeling that there's going to be the creation almost of a stipend economy. And in parts of it, that will substitute for what has traditionally been volunteerism. Volunteerism is not going to disappear, but it's going to become a more complicated landscape. So this is about, you know, in addressing the issue about working, you're not really competing for the promotion. You're not competing for the big project. It's you're doing what you really want to do, and let the people who want to compete to advance, they can go off and do what they want to do. And I think that's a really smart insight because actually that does happen a lot. And there's been this conversation in the human resources field about, and people who like Joseph Coughlin and people like that who think about this, who is there a way of formalizing that? where you, and under our legal system, you can't do that. But it's, this is the kind of thinking that's going on, where you just say, look, hey, you're not going to get the promotion anymore. You're not going to get a pay increase. But you know what? The grandkid gets born, you can take 3 weeks off. And we want you to be working on these projects. Now, in our society, in our system, you can't really do that, that form of discrimination. But so what you're doing on kind of naturally is where actually I think a lot of people sort of think things should be going toward. Pick and choose the things you like to do. Pick and choose where you can make a difference. You probably have gone through periods of your time where you worked really hard, and it's like, well, why am I doing this? So now you know why you're doing what you're doing, and let other people gain the wisdom of why am I doing this. So I think that's, and this is why I do think it's, you know, it's very easy to set up a situation where people are at each other's throat, but I think in many cases they're not. And I think this is sort of a broader thing. The other thing that has struck me, and I don't know if you've come across this, is a lot of times we have a very narrow definition about what is a job or how do you find a job or what is an acceptable job. And what has really struck me going around the country is how creative people are in coming up with something that they want to do and that wouldn't consider it under normal circumstances. You know, you wouldn't be having a conversation saying, here's, you should be thinking about this. But what it turns out is people do think about something a little bit offbeat, and they turn it into a job. The one that struck me was I was doing Minnesota Public Radio, and this guy called in, and he was in his 70s, and he said, you know, Chris, I am having a great time. And he said, I'm a driver. And I said, work for a limo company? And I said, I'm a driver, and it's great, you know, because I get to talk to people, and then if I want to go visit the grandkids, go on vacation, I just call them up, say I'm gone for the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks. They don't care. When I come back, I call them up, and they send me work. Now, to me, I can't imagine anything more miserable than driving a car. I mean, seriously, and having to talk to people. I don't want to do this. But he had constructed a way that really worked for him, and, you know, he made some money. But what he really wanted to do was make some money but still have his freedom or his flexibility. And a lot of this whole job thing is really a search for flexibility. And that cuts across the generations. It's not just older people who want flexibility in the job. It's younger people want flexibility in the job. And, you know, many companies just have not adjusted to that. And I think they're going to have to over time. So one of the questions, one of the things that seems to be missing from this whole conversation or the infrastructure as we you know deal with unretirement is a clearinghouse of information. And you're absolutely right. You cannot Google this and come up with a simple place, you know, here's where I go, or you know, whatever search engine you're going to use. There are some organizations that have been building up an infrastructure, so Encore.org. They don't actually work with individuals, but what they try and do is encourage the creation of institutions, nonprofits in an area. You have all kinds of people moving into this. It's an incredible space of entrepreneurialism. There's nonprofits being created. There are tent agencies being created. There are for-profit companies that are moving into it. You have, you know, the career coaches, the retirement coaches, the rethinking of life coaches. I mean, all kinds of stuff is going on, but there is no simple clearinghouse of information. And this is also part of where, you know, a lot of the people who are doing this are driven to do it. And most of us, we need a roadmap. We need a ramp. And that's why I think things like phased retirement, federal government's phased retirement, are so important. Because it's kind of like, okay, this is what I'm going, yeah, this is what I want to do next. And it's sort of laid out for you, as opposed to what happens in a lot of companies today. You go to your manager, and you negotiate a phased retirement. And it's kind of like a deal you strike with your manager. And it's signed off on. But if you don't have that initiative, or you don't think about it, it doesn't happen. And so you're absolutely right. But this is part of what's going on right now. And I say AARP getting much more involved in this now. They've had a little bit of a back and forth, and now they're much more embracing it. Encore.org, Women in Transition Network, Kansas City is Next Avenue. No, not Next Avenue.
Kansas City. It's Next Chapter, Twin Cities. There's a group called Shift. There's a PBS, and I write for them as an online magazine called Next Avenue, nextavenue.org. And it's trying to become that clearinghouse of information on all kinds of aspects and has a big core about working longer as a big part of it. But that's part of the what's going to be happening over the next 2-3 decades is building that infrastructure. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.